Hello there, Harold Pollock. Welcome to the Glenn Show. Harold Pollock of the University of Chicago School of Social Service Administration. Did I get that right?
You sure did.
Last time, I think I flubbed it. Blogger extraordinaire, what are we talking about today, Harold?
Well, I think we have two things to talk about. One is sort of the deserving and undeserving poor, and I think we have some, we have a little bit of cleanup from our last blogging heads where we talked about Nelson Mandela, and I think in part just to clear up some misperceptions based on at least what I thought the comment thread had indicated about our conversation.
Okay, let's do that first one first. I think the issue there is that you had said in our previous conversation, which took place shortly after Nelson Mandela's death, that back during the period when the anti-apartheid activism was at its height in the United States, you were kind of less on board with that than in retrospect maybe you wished that you had been or something like that, not to put words in your mouth, but some of our viewers misunderstood how you were characterizing your politics vis-a-vis apartheid in the 1980s, and you wanted to set the record straight.
Well, I think what's interesting about I've always been certainly appalled by apartheid and have nothing interesting to add to the fundamental injustice of the apartheid system. It's more my personal reaction to sort of the accoutrement of political solidarity. I think you and I have a trait in common most of the time, which is that when I hear the drum beating, I really don't want to follow. And that's quite independent of you know where the parade is going and the justification of the cause behind that parade. And I had when I was a college student and I saw the excitement and the sense of solidarity and conformity that came with a cause like that, I was instinctively distrustful and distanced myself from it because I felt uncomfortable with that kind of identification with that political solidarity that a cause like that occasioned. And I don't know if that resonates with you, but that was very much in my mind.
Well, it does, man. In a way, it's the story of my life. that is, this is not about apartheid or South Africa. Mm-hmm. This is about conformity, bandwagons, and crowds. And it's about fads and about trendiness and about identity. It's about feeling virtuous by standing on the right side of history because you can poke your thumb in the eye of, you know, the bad guys and you can get out and rally and sit in and demonstrate as a way of showing the virtues and, you know, sort of historical correctness to rule out argument, you know, to broach no counter narrative, to consider no complexity. To not allow as how there might be another side to the story. I'm not saying there was another respectable side to the white supremacy must end narrative about South Africa. I'm not saying that at all. But I can definitely relate to this feeling that if everybody is rushing onto the college green in order to, in unison, shout out, no more apartheid, racism must end, that might not be the dance that I would want to go to just because everybody else is doing it and it's being foisted as the essential requirement of being in political good standing. You must express yourself just as the rest of us, repeat after me, apartheid must end, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
For me, it was with respect to civil rights advocacy and the race narrative that I found myself, while not exactly disagreeing with the people who said that discrimination is bad and blacks are getting a raw deal, thinking that, I'm not going to follow that crowd. I mean, Jesus, that's the easiest thing to do, to just fall in line and mouth those incantations. Surely the problem is more complicated than that.
Now, the thing that there's a tension here, because if you want to get something done, you know, it seems to me there's a fundamental tension between political solidarity and intellectual independence, and that and what makes it difficult is you really do need to organize and get stuff done and be able to operate collectively, you know, to exercise political power. You know, there are, you know, if you're going to, you know, if you're trying to dismantle apartheid, you got to mobilize people, get them excited about it, get focused on a common strategy, and go out and do it. And that's, I totally respect that. That's what politicking is about. You know, you can't, you know, at the same time, it is also true that it makes it hard to act in the world for social justice and be an effective actor, you know, pursuing that while at the same time maintaining the kind of critical stance that you want to maintain, so that you can, first of all, as academics and intellectuals, you know, what we offer is, you know, in some ways is our intellectual independence and distance. And when we, you know, we can be propagandists for useful causes, but most of the time we want to be more than that. You know, we want to really be contributing our full intellectual apparatus.
No, I get it. If we want to get something done collectively, we're going to have to get on the same page, and that's going to mean some conformity enforcement and some, you know, political correctness. On the other hand, that's the only way that we can act effectively in concert. And yet, I must tell you, there are many contemporary issues that that I feel myself reacting to in a very similar way. For example, if people say, we've got Obamacare now, so women are no longer being discriminated against by being charged different rates for health care coverage than men. Okay. Mm-hmm. My reaction to that, and then they say it as if, aha, finally justice has come. Okay. And my reaction to that is, all right, if you wanted to socialize the cost of people requiring health care, then fine. So then what they pay doesn't necessarily relate to the expenses that their healthcare will require. You've averaged that across. Men and women may be different as a matter of objective fact in terms of the risk of requiring services, mm-hmm. which would then justify different rates for men and women. But if you want to socialize that and eliminate that, fine. Eliminate that difference, fine. But to characterize that as anti-discrimination, as if heretofore recognizing gender differences in mm-hmm. health risk exposure was some kind of moral error, is to me demagoguery. It's not. It's simply moving the risk of the expense from the individual onto the society in a particular way. But it wasn't gender discrimination in any invidious or morally problematic sense to have noticed, to the extent that it was true, that men and women at a certain stage in their lives might present different risks to someone who was incurring the obligation to insure them against their health costs. That's one of the things. Or the minimum wage must be raised to $10 an hour or $15 an hour. Well, why not make it 20? Okay. And then people tried out these arguments about a living wage and this and that. And I keep thinking the situation is more complicated than that. And I understand that Democrats believe that they can make political hay by forcing Republicans to have to vote on a minimum wage thing. And I look at the discourse about the minimum wage. They cite one study by David Card and Alan Krueger mm-hmm. Out of Princeton, which finds relatively modest or essentially no negative employment effects in a comparison of minimum wage laws, which differed between Pennsylvania and New Jersey, to states that are similar and they border each other and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. They cite one study and then they make a declaration about the fact that the minimum wage can go higher and higher. That's the decent and right thing to do. All right thinking people would be for it. And they don't make an argument. And again, it strikes me as a bandwagon that I don't necessarily want to get on. Well, I could go on.
Let me make two observations about that. One is, I wish we could make the social justice arguments more straight up. And in the case of the minimum wage, the real argument we need to make is the importance of redistributive programs that provide more economic resources to workers near the bottom of the wage spectrum. And I would much
instead of having to do it through the wage system itself. Is that what you're saying?
Well, we can then talk about the different instruments to do that. But if we create a, we need to create a public consensus that says that people who are full-time workers are entitled to a, to a higher standard of living than their market wages, would otherwise command. And that, you know, if you're working at McDonald's and supporting two kids, that we need to make sure that you have an adequate bundle of goods that you can afford. Now, minimum wage is one instrument to do that. I would rather see, in my ideal world, we would use straight transfers to do that through things like the earned income tax credit.
And we could then. I agree with that. I agree both with the normative sentiment that we want to help such people and with the judgment that the preferable way to do it would not be by pricing some of them out of the market by forcing employers to pay a wage higher than what the market estimates their labor services to be worth.
Now, by the way, one of the things that I find strange in the argument is people give this argument, we're subsidizing Walmart when people go on food stamps who are Walmart workers or whatever. I mean, I think there's a lot that I find troubling about the way Walmart operates and its labor policies, but I don't find troubling that if you're a low-wage worker working at Walmart that you're getting Medicaid or other kinds of support, with public subsidies. It seems to me that we should be doing more of that because that's the way that we can actually help people while also, I think the more explicit we are in what these programs are about, the more likely we are to help people without creating unintended consequences. I think now the minimum wage, I think there's a series of questions about the, the relevant elasticities of supply and demand to know, what is the impact of a marginal change in the minimum wage. And it seems to me we should be fairly empirical about, what we think of this as a policy. It does seem to me that the minimum wage has lagged quite a bit in real terms over time. And so I'm certainly receptive to the idea that it may be time for an increase, but it seems to me we should be able to fairly argue the empirics of it without a presumption that, that the people who are on one side of the fence are, people who are opposing an increase are doing it because they don't think inequality is a problem. Now, it happens that many of the people on that side, have values that I disagree with, but we should be able to have the minimum wage debate more straight up than it's possible to do.
Well, I regard myself as a guy who's left of center, but I have to tell you, I'm not really that moved by this idea that the real value of the minimum wage must be kept at, whatever it was in 1980 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I agree with you. There are empirical questions here about the effects. But at a conceptual level, the idea that my anti-poverty strategy is to force employers to pay a wage higher than what they estimate the worth of a worker's labor services to be, somebody who's flipping burgers mm-hmm. at McDonald's or sweeping up in the back room or washing dishes mm-hmm. or trimming the hedge, higher than what one estimates their labor services to be worth, that just strikes me as an intellectually impoverished response to the problem of people being in need. And to make an ideological totem out of it, to say if you're on the right side of history, you're for this thing, feels coercive to me. And I was offering mm-hmm. it as an example of a bandwagon mm-hmm. that I don't want to get on. That's a march that I don't want to join. And that's the sense in which I could identify with what you were saying earlier about your reaction to anti-apartheid activism in the 1980s.
Let me give you a second example, by the way, which relates to – it's interesting. I've been on the Obama bandwagon in some ways. I'm very proud of supporting candidate Obama, then President Obama, and supporting the Affordable Care Act, which I'm very proud of despite, its shortcomings. I think this week we actually saw a very interesting example of where the bandwagon effect leads people to embrace talking points that go past the data and that ultimately actually prove damaging in a way. If it's actually true that we raise the minimum wage and it leads to strong employment effects, for example, clearly that would be a problem. Well, here one example that we get in health reform that's interesting is this argument that if we cover people, that we will save money by reducing inappropriate use of the emergency department. And there was just a study that came out yesterday that showed that, in fact, if you cover people in Medicaid, that they use the emergency department 40% more, at least, than their comparable peers who are uninsured. Now, I should tell you that that's what the way I just described it is the way it's been covered in the newspapers. And so the liberal talking point is debunked. But here's a couple other facts about it. The total cost of this turns out that 40% of what? It turns out it's one extra emergency department visit every 3.5 years. And the total and the annualized cost of this is $120 a year per person. So substantively, it's actually not important. And it's not even clear to me that reducing emergency department visits is a sensible policy goal to begin with, since what you'd want to know is what are they doing there and, you know, how valuable is that visit. But there was never really any evidence behind the talking point that we could save much money by reducing emergency room visits this way. But it was a very congenial talking point. And many people, were citing it quite a bit. And so now we have actually a good study that says, well, this talking point is incorrect. And people have inferred from that it is, undermining the case for providing people with health insurance. And in fact, it doesn't. It's just that by putting out a non-evidence-based talking point, we have, instead of straight up saying, everybody needs to have access to health coverage, we've created by making a poor argument, we've created, we've undermined our own cause once the data where it was in.
Yeah.
And
I see.
And so you imagine you increase the minimum wage, and in fact, there are some adverse consequences to it that people didn't take seriously. Then you would say, well, we've actually damaged the cause of helping low-income workers because we didn't talk about some of the potential things that might happen. Now, I don't think that raising the minimum wage to $10 is, I think it's probably a policy I'd favor on balance, because I just don't think politically we can get some of the other ways to increase wages, that I'd like to see. But I think we should be open to the possibility that it will be, ineffective or have some undesirable side effects, and we need to consider that.
Well, that's a problem, it seems to me, with our politics. You say we can't politically get the right policy, therefore, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but therefore, let's take what we can get. That sounds very similar to what many people on the left say about Obamacare, about the Affordable mm-hmm. Care Act. They say we can't get the right policy, which would be, basically a single payer covering everybody. That's politically infeasible, so let's do the thing that we can do. And in so doing, the non-transparency and the ill fit between the policy mechanisms and the normative ideals creates all kinds of problems. We see them playing themselves out now mm-hmm. with not just the website, but with all of the other difficulties that the Obamacare rollout is encountering.
It's interesting. My experience of the past 5 years has convinced me of two things. One is the practical superiority of a single payer system, at least a well-implemented one. And the other is the political impossibility of a single payer system, at least in the short run. And so many of, it's so frustrating listening to the criticisms of Obamacare, because we have 50 million uninsured people, and people are losing homes because they get cancer. People have diabetes, and they're having a foot amputated because they can't get proper medical care. And this is happening every day to hundreds of thousands of people within a bicycle ride of where I'm sitting right now, some version of that.
Yeah.
The human stakes are large. Now, we can wait until we have the assassination of John Kennedy and a massive change in American politics that opens the opens the political possibilities for a single payer system, or we can not wait a quarter century or whatever it's going to be and do something that's very worthy and that actually, in a longer term sense, I think is actually working okay. It's implemented. There's 9 million people now who are in the process of getting insurance or who already have insurance because of Obamacare, whose lives are being improved. And the dismissal of incremental politics that some critics of Obamacare have taken, to me, is it illustrates the triumph of ideological purity over the need to be pragmatic and to actually help people when we have opportunities to do that.
I think that's only part of the story, Harold. I'm thinking about Jennifer Hochschild's book, The New American Dilemma. It's about 1985. Hochschild is a political scientist at Harvard. The book is about school desegregation. It's a classic because it takes on this question of incremental versus radical reform, arguing against incrementalism. In the case of school desegregation, the incrementalism has to do with whether you come in and basically use forced busing to integrate the schools, where you give parents essentially very little voice in how that's going to be done, and you give them very little recourse. So you integrate central city and suburban school systems into a single metropolitan entity for the purposes of affecting desegregation so that the white parents can't escape it by moving to the boundaries of the metropolitan area. And you do other things of that sort. That's radical. What we opted for was incremental relative to something like that. The Supreme Court and legislatures and local policymakers and municipal, you know, school systems and so forth opted for incrementalism. And what you got was resistance, 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 resistance at every turn, such that after 40 years, one looks and sees the schools are pretty much still racially segregated. And the point I'm trying to make with the example is incrementalism might really be worse than doing nothing until you can do it right if what you put in place ends up impeding the accomplishment of the goals that you were trying to achieve by creating interests who can more effectively resist doing what you want to do. I don't know if this applies in healthcare, but we have put this in the hands of the insurance companies.
Well, let me make a couple comments about that.
You know,
I think there's a couple interesting comments.
Go ahead.
One is I do agree that one of the hypotheses about Obamacare is that it creates a platform for more for improved policies. By the way, we don't actually need a single payer to achieve many of the social justice objectives we care about. And I think there's a fetishization of a particular mechanism to deliver health care that we can talk about. There, it's not clear, you know.
Harold, I have to ask you to hold on just a minute. Just 5 seconds.
I mean, Medicare.
My dog was barking. I needed to close the door. Go ahead.
That's okay. Maybe it was barking, no doubt, agreement with my talking points there. So I think there's a fetishization of a Medicare for all approach when many of the social democracies have other ways of achieving universal coverage and cost control and so on, which may be more feasible. That's one point. The second point is it's not a question of opted for. It's a question of how much power do you have to do the things that you want to do. It's not like we opted against a single payer system. Candidates Obama, Edwards, and Clinton and the major constituencies on the left of the Democratic Party in the wake of the Clinton debacle 20 years ago realized if we want to move towards universal coverage, this is the way we are going to do it. And the fact is that Obamacare is quite similar to what John Edwards or Hillary Clinton would have done. They hoped to have a public option, which would have moved us closer than we were able to get. But there was a realization, hey, we only have so much power. Now, I think there's one further point where there's an interesting parallel between integration and the healthcare system, which I think Hochschild's book brings out, is people equate democratic decision-making with decentralized and fragmented decision-making. And that one of the challenges we have as a society is that if we make education policy on the basis of autonomous and small geographic distributions where people are mobile, we really can't end up in a situation where we deal with some of the larger social challenges that we have. And you cannot redistribute, from the old TIBU literature on, we know you cannot redistribute resources if you allow such fragmentation. And I think that the same is true in healthcare. We have too many decision points in health policy, too much fragmentation geographically, politically, institutionally. And as a result, and even if we had a single payer system, we would still have many of the same problems that as a result, we really are not able to do things like control costs, which really require more centralized decision making in certain dimensions. And
wait a minute, I'm not following you here. I follow the point that decentralization creates problems for change because people can play one jurisdiction off against the other. But what I'm not following is how a single payer system wouldn't get around that because it would centralize at the federal level the financial responsibility for covering people's health care costs. And it would seem to get around the
it would get around some issues, but if you say but the problem is the federal system is not is itself fragmented. If you look at the political economy of federal health policy with all the congressional committees, all of the influence of local constituencies, my guess is that the people who ran Medicare under the Bush administration and the Obama administration have much more in common with each other than either one does with, say, the head of a relevant House committee where there's a wheelchair factory in that person's district. And, we have tremendous collective action problems in the Medicare program everyone believes we should control the cost of Medicare. Everyone rails against the deficit right up until the point where you put anything concrete on the table. And you realize, well, wait a minute, this actually affects different places and different constituencies in different ways. And as a society, we have to deal with this problem because you look at the deep resistance. I think people in the Senate and the House have figured out that from their perspective, the collective action problem is actually not a problem. It's a feature that, that I can, as an individual legislator, if I have the ability to micromanage Medicare, this gives me tremendous advantages as a political actor. And, it's a very public choice kind of a problem that we have that if we did a single payer system, we would have to find ways to do it that create a different political economy around these programs. But anyway, that's probably for another conversation.
It is. Let's talk because my time's a little limited here. As yours well may be as well, about the other issue that we want to talk about, which was the so-called culture of poverty, or how would you want to frame it?
A lot in the news right now talking in a way that harkens back, of course, to very old debates about deserving versus undeserving poor. I think about Paul Ryan's recent sort of involvement in, in low-income communities and the juxtaposition of the Ryan budget with some of the comments he's making about the importance of the spiritual uplift of people in poverty and that we need to...
Can you explain that a little bit? Because I don't think I've followed it as closely as you have. What has Ryan said, and how does it invoke this issue of deserving versus undeserving?
He's basically saying one of the key ways we need to help poor people is he uses the word spiritual, and it's really that we need to provide. The way that I read that, I must say, like a lot with Paran, the details are not as fleshed out as one would like, but I interpret that in a way that suggests that the problem of poverty is really one of the values and behaviors and response to incentives of poor people themselves, and that we need to help poor people make better decisions, and that the structural poverty problem we have in America is that we've created an economic and a social environment that allows people to make poor choices and encourages people to make poor choices. And if we could counsel people to make better choices, that this is a key way to reduce poverty, and that true compassion is dealing with these underlying moral and incentive issues facing the poor. And
you're saying, well, that's wrong.
I think I have two reactions to that. One is that I am repelled by it because I juxtapose it with the Ryan budget, which would have absolutely enacted serious cuts in, you know, many programs, and including many programs that serve working people of low income who are actually doing all of the things that we want them to be doing, you know, sort of cutting.
Okay, so here's a guy who wants to preach to the poor to pull up their socks, even as he's cutting off their lifeline. And for many of the people who depend on that lifeline, they're pulling those socks just as hard as
they possibly there's something could. It's literally adding insult to injury to say that I'm going to cut programs to help you, and to compensate for that, I'm going to give you some spiritual advice. You know, to me, that is, I find that terrible.
Okay, now what about the possibility that the programs are not always helpful because they may lock people into poverty by dulling their incentives to take care of themselves? And what about the possibility that if you get pregnant at 16, if you drop out of high school, if you start running with a drug selling gang, if you go for 2 or 3 years without a job or without looking for a job, then you're really laying the foundation for a life of poverty and for a life of poverty for your children. And that's something that if you behave differently, you wouldn't do. Are both of those things wrong?
Well, I actually think they're not both wrong, but I think that they're not connected in the way that he wants to connect them. I do think there's an unavoidable moral and cultural dimension of poverty that you know, people on the left, you know, if someone gives a seminar at the University of Chicago and you say, you know, you're really making a culture of poverty argument, that's basically, you've just dropped a bomb on whatever that person is saying. And I'm sure you've been in the room where that's occurred. You know, that's anathema to say that I'm making, you know, to point to the cultural dimension of poverty. And I do think that's unfortunate because there is a cultural dimension to it, which just can't be ignored. I just read, Chris.
So you and Paul Ryan agree about
that? Well, we agree that there is a cultural dimension, but there's two things about it. One is that that has nothing to do with whether I should be cutting school lunches and cutting a series of, you know, denying people health insurance and so on. I mean, to me, giving someone Medicaid coverage does not it is not, you know, he referred to he said we need a safety net and not a hammock. And to me, that is, there's a sense of distance communicated by that. And he's also referred to, we have a society where there are more takers than makers. And, you know, he uses this kind of language, which, you know, he is not part of the community of the poor that in a way that gives him the legitimacy, the subtlety, the authority to be giving this kind of instruction. And, you know, I think that, you know, if you go into any church on the south side of Chicago on a Sunday morning, you're going to hear plenty of moralizing by people who are actually in the lives of the people that they are talking to. And I don't think that.
Okay. So he does not have standing, if I may. He lacks standing to be engaging in that kind of cultural criticism. There is a cultural criticism to be made, but not by people who live a million miles away from these communities, know nothing of their internal complexity or workings, and who are mainly about the business of trying to cut off what little support the government is providing.
I mean, for example, if you look at these programs in their particularity, you realize it's often the responsible thing for people to use them. You know, suppose I'm a single mom and I work, you know, mopping the floor at Mercy Hospital in Chicago, and I'm eligible for some public benefits, school lunches or, you know, chip for my kids, whatever it is. You know, if I want to make a better life for my kids, I should be using those programs. Now, I should be reading to my kids at night and all the other stuff I should be doing. But there's nothing in the fact that I'm using food stamps that is discrediting to me as a person, as a parent, and in fact, it may be the opposite, that I'm attempting to mobilize the resources available to me to give my kids a better life and to sort of The participation in transfer programs is often a very worthy thing for parents to do because they otherwise couldn't afford to support their families properly. And, you know, if you...
It seems to me you're saying, and I certainly agree with this, if this is what you're saying, that there's no necessary conflict between helping people on the one hand by providing material resources when they are in need and exhorting them to live well on the other hand, which they well may need to hear from time to time because there are ways of living that are more effective with respect to, you know, acculturating your children or maintaining your own independence or whatever it might be. And people should be encouraged. They should be encouraged not to smoke tobacco. It's bad for their health. Drink alcohol in excess.
By the way, there's no they there. We all should be encouraged about these things.
Indeed. Thank you. I stand corrected.
Yeah, I think that it is. There's also a dimension that there's an idea that the moral instruction that needs to take place is directed towards poor people from everybody else, and that the reason we have poverty, to my mind, one of the most important things to understand is we do not have poverty because there is a group of Americans who have a particular set of pathological values. We have poverty for lots of reasons. But it is not the individual defects of poor people that's the fundamental cause of most of the poverty that we see. We have a particular set of economic and political and geographic and all kinds of things that generate our income distribution. There are people who end up disadvantaged by that.
Let me play the devil's advocate here for a minute, because within these communities and these structural situations with low employment, poor education, lack of various supports, all kinds of chaotic things going on within them, there is variation in the individual's achievement. Not everybody born into a public housing project grows up to be poor, you know? And so do I not learn something about the individual level virtues that are connected with prosperity and financial independence by observing the success stories that come out of disadvantaged backgrounds in contrast to those who have been less successful there? And shouldn't I exhort people in that circumstance to emulate those amongst their fellows who, despite the difficult conditions, have nevertheless been able to wrest a decent life?
Oh, absolutely. I'll give you one example of that is we see the incredible upward mobility among low-income Asian American immigrants. And if you go into Chinatowns across the United States, you see things like low-cost tutoring services that people have set up on a shoestring. Yeah. And you see families making enormous sacrifices. And if you just look at the student body at Stuyvesant High School or any of the elite selective schools in the United States, you know, you see that there are, the children who come from these backgrounds are maximizing the opportunities that they are facing, and that's a reality that I think we have to honor and point to. I don't think though that's enough, or that's really. Now, to me, there is an element. It's not a complete element, but there is an element of, you and I have talked before about the dog bone economy, where there's, if there's 100 people trying to sit in 88 chairs, 12 people are not going to get a chair. And if you look at those 12 people, there might well be something wrong with them. But if you fix those 12 people, there'd be another 12 people that might not get a chair. And, in the current macroeconomic climate that we have, a lot of people are being squeezed out, and we can help a particular person not be the person squeezed out, but there still will be people squeezed out. And I don't think that the dog bone economy is sort of an extreme example, but I think that by focusing on individual defects, we are very deliberately avoiding a conversation about larger structures of opportunity.
About structure, I agree.
So I think the Pope, by the way, is such an interesting addition to this conversation, because he's really the new Pope.
The Pope
he's an economic egalitarian, and he's also a Christian moralizer. And for him, there is no inconsistency in those positions. And he's making everybody across the political spectrum uncomfortable in what he's saying. And he's very specifically criticized trickle-down economics by name. And
I heard that and I was stunned by that.
And one of the interesting things is the conservative response, because, of course, there's a whole group of Catholic conservatives who've spent the past 25 years telling liberal Catholics, well, you just basically have to suck it up and be obedient to church authority. And this is church teaching. And now all of a sudden, these conservatives are becoming cafeteria Catholics. And you hear, you know, Paul Ryan, for example, making the claim that, well, the Pope, he was exposed to capitalism in Argentina, and this is, you know, it's different in the United States, and he's not an economist. And, you know, the words trickle-down were not invented in Argentina, as far as I know. But I think that I think the Pope will make everyone uncomfortable because he really – I don't agree, of course, with a lot of what he has to say, but he is – making both of those arguments in a way that no one else, you know, right now of that of similar prominence is able to do, I mean, the idea that we need to be preaching to poor people to read to your kids, but we also need to be preaching to rich people. You know, we have really been you know, those of us who are in the upper 20% of the income distribution have really, I think, been. You know, been selfish in the way that we have operated in public policy towards issues of inequality and the basic needs that many people in the society who are much less fortunate, are facing.
Yeah, I want to circle back a little bit to we started this conversation basically talking about political correctness and about each of us having a certain distaste for following the crowd. And now we're talking about poverty and about deservingness and the extent to which the poor might be implicated in their own circumstances by their behavior and so on. Mm-hmm. And I see a connection between those two. And I was reminded that the two, I mean, you pointed to this when you said at one point in our conversation that if you were to even mutter the words culture of poverty or cultural causes of poverty in an academic setting, you'd likely be laughed off as a Neanderthal, as a politically backward, right wing hack for simply invoking that possibility. And that strikes me as a debilitating kind of political correctness. And I thought I saw an example of it recently on the New York Times op-ed page when Charles Blow, the columnist there, an African-American as it happens, and a progressive, took Rand Paul, Kentucky senator and libertarian, to task after Rand Paul said regarding extending long-term unemployment benefits in this recession, which are about to run out, and this is an issue before the Congress, you might not be doing a favor for the unemployed by extending long-term unemployment benefits, since the longer someone stays out of the workforce, the less employable that they're going to be when they try to get back in it. And you essentially create disincentives for people to get to work. Now, this argument has been laughed off the stage out of hand by many people, and Charles Blow was amongst them. He takes Paul to task as being heartless and as, viewing the poor through a lens of them being responsible for their own poverty. Blow is proud to tell us that just because you're poor doesn't mean you're lazy. He wants to remind us that he himself was once poor, but he knows that poor people are not lazy. And it strikes me that that kind of talk is overly simplistic, because it seems to me there is something to the concern that when we create incentives for people to remain unemployed by extending their unemployment benefits again and again and again, we might undermine their impetus to seek employment. It's just a question of observing that incentives affect people's behavior. In no way does it characterize the poor as being lazy. It simply says we need to think about what the incentive effects of this policy might be. It's an empirical question, not a moral question.
Let me attack that in two pieces. I think there's an empirical argument there which needs to be made. And obviously, there's an article to be written for the Journal of Selection Bias, which shows that people who are you know, we shouldn't extend unemployment because people who've been long-term unemployed are less likely to be hired. And obviously, you know, there's lots of reasons why you can't immediately draw that inference given the selection into that population.
That's a subtle point, Harold. I'm not sure everybody's going to follow it. I do. So, you're just saying that people are differentially employable, and that if we see amongst people who've been unemployed for a long, long time, it's likely that they will disproportionately consist of people who are not so employable. And therefore, to infer that their long term of unemployment caused them to not find a job could be wrong. It may be that they weren't going to find a job in any case.
Absolutely. Unemployment insurance does not cause long-term inability to find a job. But, you know, you will certainly find a lot of these long-term people will have trouble. I actually think the incentive issues and the psychological issues are probably not at the 99th week, but they're at like the 20th week. And there's an interesting behavioral economics problem that I think we need to be more imaginative about. And I think one of the things that reinforces your point is I'd like to see unemployment extended, but I think that the empirical question that Paul is raising needs to be taken seriously. What I'm concerned about is there's a lot of evidence that if you've been unemployed a long time, at some point employers just stop reading your resume. You know, we have a lot of people who are jobless who are looking for jobs. And if you're out for more than 6 months or whatever the particular time period is, at some point employers become much less interested in you. And now you really become unemployable just by the duration of your unemployment to some degree. And one of the challenges that people have when they lose a job is they very often, you know, it's a very difficult thing because one of the things you have to often do is you have to take another job that's at much lower pay or that is a less attractive job. And asking someone who's just lost a job, you know, you really should take this job that pays 40% less than your old job. Wow, that's a hard thing. It's a hard thing for people to accept, and it's a hard thing, you know, to tell someone. But I think strategically that may be the best advice. And one of the I think creative suggestions that people have had to deal with this problem is wage insurance that takes the form you lose your job and you take another job. For the first 3 or 4 months or whatever the period is, we will pay you the difference in your wage between your old wage and the new wage. You can keep looking.
Is that your idea, Harold, or are you repeating something that someone else has proposed? Because
it's not my idea. It's an idea that was proposed. There's a paper by Sendel, Melanathan, and Larry Katz, and I think maybe some others on it, on the behavioral economics of unemployment, which struck me as very real because I've talked to unemployed people, and I've certainly seen this process, as I'm sure you have as well. And so it basically says take a reasonable job, even if it's not that attractive to you. We will cover for some period of time your wage loss. You can keep looking for a job. Yeah. If you get another job, great. But if you don't get another job, hey, you're employed. And you don't suddenly face the stigma of being someone who's been out of a job for a long time and all of the things that does that make it hard for you to get another job. And we actually should be – what I worry about is if the debate is about extending unemployment insurance and that becomes the litmus test – for how we're going to help people, that we will forget about. There actually is a very real problem that Paul's trying to get to. That now, even if one disagrees with what he's saying, now I do think that, you know, I said that Paul Ryan didn't have standing. I must say, my reaction to Rand Paul is somewhat similar. That it's somewhat naive to view his comments about unemployment insurance in complete isolation from the broader libertarian agenda and so on. And I mean, there's everything does occur in a political context and part of someone's larger political story. And his larger political story is not one that I or many other people would find congenial. So you're sort of asking me a lot to say, take what he's saying now at face value and forget about, you know, everything else in the file. I don't know quite how to think about those issues.
Yeah, well, just because a guy's a libertarian doesn't mean he's wrong about everything. And the possibility that he might have at least a point worth investigating with respect to the incentive and behavioral consequences of extending unemployment, and that the point you're making now, there are many other instruments that one might think about employing if one wants to help the unemployed, other than simply extending their unemployment benefits. But seems to me to be these are points worth making, and they've got
that's fair enough. But it seems to me one of the things that I recoil from is you have politicians who on a series of issues, whether it's health reform, food stamps, whatever it is, have said basically, you know, it is not worth the money to support this redistributive program. You know, we have a deficit, we have to set priorities, we have too many people who are takers and not makers, etc. And then an issue comes up and the person says, you know, I'm really worried about these poor people, but I'm just worried that this is not going to help them. So we really should cut this program. And there is, to the extent that they are attempting to derive authority for their argument on the basis of their personal concern for people facing unemployment or whatever it is, I don't see a lot in the rest of their policy record that to me gives them an awful lot of standing to at least seek that kind of authority. They may be right empirically, but
I don't agree with you here, Harold. I really don't. I mean, a guy or a woman can be a conservative. They can think that the government is too big. They can be really dubious about all the schemes hatched on the left to help the poor. And they can still care about the poor. And the fact that they don't want to universalize Head Start, the fact that they think that a government control of the healthcare system, put those words in inverted commas, is a bad thing in the road to socialism, the fact that they think that taxes are too high in this country and that we don't get enough from the public sector in return for the money that we give up, the fact that they prize individual freedom does not make them anti-poor or without sympathy for people who are disadvantaged. It may be that they go to a church, that they give 10% of their income to charity, that they're involved in the Little League or Big Brother or whatever it is. All those things are still possible. So I don't know how you would know from the voting record of someone in Congress whether or not they actually have sympathy.
Well, I don't think I can judge them as a person, whether they're a good person. But I think that I can say that if they're arguing about public policy and they're implicitly saying, in evaluating my policy recommendation, I'm putting out there that I'm really concerned about these people, I would say, well, based on what I can see, I don't see a whole lot in the record, in the public policy record, that makes that real. And
well, the guy's got to say, he or she have got to say, prefacing their opposition to the minimum wage hike, that they're concerned about poor people because their political opponents are eviscerating them by characterizing them as clueless and unconcerned about the poor simply because they think that raising the minimum wage would not be a good idea. When in fact, it's an arguable question to which evidence can be brought to bear as to what the causal effects of raising the minimum wage are. And, you know, people who think that it's not a good policy are not, you know, there's nothing bizarre about that. That's a reasonable person could arrive
at. You know, I agree with you that is the fair way that we should respond to public policy argument. What often makes that difficult is the empirical reality that a good percentage of these people actually are clueless and don't care about poor people. And I mean, I'll just put that out there. I just think that if you propose something like the Ryan budget and you look at the practical implications for human beings across America, they're so terrible that to me, the fact that you then show up at a soup kitchen and establish a personal connection, even if you are actually in your church or whatever a good person, what you're proposing in public policy is so harmful that it's very hard for me to take at face value, although I think that's the fair way that I should be debating policy points. It's very hard for me to then take the next issue and view it in isolation from a fairly appalling set of things that came before it. And it is, because we are, especially because we are in a real political fight in America. And, you know, just to circle back to the beginning of the conversation, political solidarity is important because there's real resources at stake. And, you know, there's real stuff that we're fighting about. And if Paul Ryan is elected president, I think poor people in America will be much better, will be much worse off than if, say, Hillary Clinton is elected president. And not everybody's going to agree with me on that, but I feel that pretty strongly. And so there's a real fight going on that matters. And
looks like we've got fodder for future conversations, Harold. I think 2016 is going to be an interesting year. We're not there yet, but the prospect of Paul Ryan running against Hillary Clinton just makes me lick my chops. I think Blogging Heads is going to
have a good year. But I should say I will not be a political advocate, but I'm sure I'll be supporting the liberal candidate, whoever that is.